I recently heard the most wonderful story. LeVar Burton, who I know first as Geordi LaForge, my six-year-old self's very favorite character in Star Trek The Next Generation, and then as LeVar Burton of Reading Rainbow, the children's television classic, and much later as Kunta Kinte in the ABC television miniseries adaptation of Alex Haley's Roots. LeVar Burton has a podcast. It's called LeVar Burton Reads, and it is every bit the grown-up Reading Rainbow that I did not know I had always dreamed of. He shared a piece recently from award-winning sci-fi and fantasy author N.K. Jemisin's anthology, How Long Till Black Future Month. I can give you no better introduction to the piece than to read a little bit of it. Cuisine de Memoir. The name of the first entree made me groan. La Morte de Marie Antoinette, the menu proclaimed, followed by a list of dishes. Coq au vin, hearth bread. Chateau de Brun Chardonnay of 1787, parentheses, final pressing before Messieurs Brand themselves met the guillotine. I looked up at my friend and dining companion Yvette, who smiled. Now, don't be ornery, Harold, she said. Her St. Charles accent stretched now into two distinct syllables and slurred my name into one. I told you to keep an open mind. Oh, my mind is open, I said, though I'm wondering whether you've lost yours. The final meal of Marie Antoinette. This is a joke, right? I'm planning to get that, she said, pointing to another item on the menu. I followed her finger and saw, on the occasion of King Edward VIII of England's announcement to the royal family of his intent to marry Wallace Simpson, even if it meant abdication of the throne. Clear turtle soup. Lobster mousse with piquant sauce, roast pheasant, potato souffle, mixed greens, fresh pineapple and cheese savory, coffee, and liqueurs. Well, at least they don't just do executions, I said. She rolled her eyes and tapped the menu again. The point is importance, meaning, the chance to share in an historic moment or a moment historic only to use. Use some damned imagination, Harold. If you don't like what's on the menu, then order a custom meal. I flipped to the menu's third page, reading the instructions regarding custom meals. Any meal from any occasion, the caption read. In fine print, restaurant patron must be able to provide the exact date. I set the menu down and rubbed my eyes. All right, I'll admit this is as original as jokes go, but it's not very funny. Yvette smiled in that knowing Mona Lisa way that had entranced and infuriated three husbands. Just try it, Harold, she said. It's my treat, after all. If you're disappointed, there is no loss, but I doubt you'll be disappointed. I shook my head. There is nothing special about this food, Yvette. This is someone's idea of a bizarre theme restaurant. Who could possibly know for certain what someone had for dinner 300 years ago? They could make up the menu out of whole cloth, and nobody could contradict them. Now, I won't spoil the story too thoroughly for you. You really deserve to hear LeVar Burton read it. But what you need to know is that our friend Harold gets all too involved in the memory of a woman he has loved and is caught in a situation which causes staff to look at him with disappointment and his friend to shake her head and rub her temples as if her head aches. She says, "People can get lost in their memories, Harold. You're worse than anyone else I know. Angelina's alive right here in this city, and all you've ever had to do was call her. But what do? You go looking for the Angelina you lost years ago. I don't know what to do with you." People can get lost in their memories. People can get stuck in their ideas or feelings about how things used to be. We chase around after moments that can only be felt in a taste. Ephemeral, fleeting, gone. The best and the worst moments of our lives are equally impossible to hold still, try though we may. The kitten I brought home at the end of the summer, who was only this big, is 3 times as big as she was when I brought her home and growing. I can never recapture the feeling I had when I was 25 and alone in my apartment in Berkeley for the first time, waiting for seminary to begin. A lot of us are older than we ever thought we'd be. And everything from the avocados turning rapidly too ripe on your counter to the styrofoam packaging that literally everything came in for a while will eventually be unrecognizable as the objects they once were. We hate it. We want our children and our kittens little forever. We want to build stone monuments to make ourselves eternal. We want to believe that there was once a perfect moment. And we want to believe that if we just tried hard enough, we could have it back. Our nostalgic habit can be a burden for humans, even when what we're remembering is personal, specific, and clear as day. But things get exponentially more complicated when what we're remembering was traumatic, when what we're remembering was also seen from 10, 20, 100, a few thousand, millions or billions of other perspectives. When we're subject to years of myth-making after the fact, or any of this stuff in combination. I always dread the week of September 11th, because it is never a normal week. We never don't have a weird time that week. Not anymore, at least. On Tuesday, this September, when it was September 11th, Paul Rykoff, who I understand to be a well-respected expert on the new veteran community and policy, and who has definitely done some very admirable work as both a critic of the Iraq War and an advocate for appropriate care and support for all veterans, got on CNN and told anchor Breonna Keller that 9/12/2001 was, and I quote, "the one time in my lifetime where the politics all went away and we were united as Americans. If we can capture that spirit again," he said, "I think it can drive us forward into the future." I don't mean to pick on Rykoff here. He is hardly the only person I heard sharing that sentiment. In fact, among a certain set of Americans, let's go back to September 12, 2001, seemed to be the year's designated never forget rallying cry. And given our context, I can certainly see why. We are told constantly that we live in the most politically polarized times in modern history, and at what often feels like a neck-breaking pace, we are seeing the facades of our liberal, in the classical sense, democracy melt away. The modern world is, even for those of us enculturated to its speed a little earlier in life, dizzying and terrifying. In the 2018 Netflix special, Kid Gorgeous, comedian John Mulaney explains the experience. It's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. I think eventually everything's going to be okay, but I have no idea what's going to happen next. And neither do any of you. And neither do your parents. Because there is a horse loose in the hospital. It's never happened before. No one knows what the horse is going to do next, least of all the horse. He's never been in a hospital before. He's as confused as you are. There are no experts. And he's right. Here we are, perpetually reeling from rapid succession nonsense fascism, in what somehow has felt since February like the middle of a potentially pointless and never-ending election cycle, desperate for an expert and aching for some way to claw ourselves back to some moment before anybody let the horse in the hospital. The memory of 9/11 is an easy place to sink hooks in. It's easy to remember that differently than it was. And when we're experiencing this upheaval, it's easy to be desperate for something that at least felt clear. In The Fire Next Time, foundational American novelist, playwright, and activist James Baldwin writes, "Try to imagine how you would feel if you woke up one morning to find the sun shining and all of the stars aflame. You would be frightened because it is out of the order of nature. Any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it so profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality." It's clear that for some people, 9/12/2001 likely did feel like a moment of solemn harmony. The record is really clear that a lot of people, from first responders and hospital workers to all manner of everyday folks, went above and beyond the ordinary in their efforts to care for others. There was undeniably heroism. Americans love to be heroes. We're pretty good at it. Certainly, as well, there was a sense of unity and camaraderie among many communities who felt that they were in it together. But unlike when the Avengers wreck several city blocks in a fight with a completely distinct and alien other, and the screen fades to black and we leave, we actually have to stick around for the cleanup of this kind of mess. We actually have to sort through the mess of confusion that comes of living in a world where we are fundamentally vulnerable to one another. A world where fear and ignorance easily combine to demonize populations, and violence serves as an easy and state-supported method of calming the terror of experiencing vulnerability. On 9/11/2001, I was 13 years old and a high school freshman at the only public high school in a Northeast Ohio town of roughly 10,000 people. Even from there, this mythical era of apolitical unity seemed to be primarily an illusion. On the basis of that solidarity, we entered into a series of wars that many on the left found politically impossible to avoid. I doubt that I need to recount for you the number of people, American, Afghani, Iraqi, or otherwise, who have died since we began a war in Afghanistan in 2001 and another in Iraq in 2003. In testimony given to the United States Commission on Civil Rights on October 10th, 2001, I'll say that date a bunch of times, October 10th, 2001, Dr. James Zoghbi, founder and president of the Arab American Institute, stated that at the time, October 10th, 2001, this is not even a full month down the road from the unified dream days of September 12th, there had been 7 deaths, 90 other physical assaults, 85 incidents of vandalism, and an uncounted but large number of other threats and harassments towards Muslims in contexts which appeared to be hate crimes. The reports of my Muslim friends who were living and growing up everywhere from Kentucky to Queensland, Australia, bear out the claim in Dr. Zoghbi's testimony that even the reported numbers of threats and harassment were shockingly low. South Indian comedian Hari Kondabolu and Punjabi rapper Himanshu Shuri, both raised by Hindu immigrant parents in Queens, write extensively in their respective formats about their experiences of violence as young brown men in a post-9/11 New York. There were some unities. But clearly there was not one transcendent experience of an apolitical and unfragmented world. Perhaps the white people in my hometown who fervently painted American flags on their garage doors and refused to let the marching band practice outside for over a week, lest our insignificant town be the next target. Perhaps in that moment they felt some oneness with white New Yorkers and Angelenos on September 12th, but it faded away into a distrust of big city elites the second there was something to pay for. And it was all but gone by the time a member of my graduating class was killed by an IED in Iraq on his 21st birthday. Clearly, brown people and religious minorities, particularly brown people who are religious minorities, felt and feel solidarity, the kind of very American solidarity built on shared and continued experiences of trauma. To this day, in addition to continued attacks on Muslims, there are reports of attacks on Hindus, Sikhs, Orthodox Christians, Orthodox Jews, and secular folks who are perceived to be too foreign, too Middle Eastern, whatever that means, and too other to be allowed any peace. According to a November 2017 Pew Research Center report, in 2016, the number of reported assaults against Muslims rose above 2001 levels for the first time. There's that horse again. Yeah, there is a horse in our hospital, and it is both very weird and very upsetting. But if I might mix my metaphors here, perhaps the stars were already on fire. As he wraps his lengthy and frankly hilarious horse joke, Mulaney says, "When people say, 'How come you were never mad at the last guy?' I say, because I wasn't paying any attention. I used to pay less attention before it was a horse. Also, I thought the last guy was pretty smart and he seemed good at his job. And I'm lazy by nature, so I don't check up on people when they seem okay at their job." He's being funny, but no matter how much it pains the lifelong political nerd in me, not to mention how much it pains each and every fiber of me that aches for examined lives, examined theologies, and examined politics. I know he's expressing something really, really true. True for him, true for a lot of Americans for whom politics has long been at best a spectator sport and one they're rather less invested in than football. At this point, you might be saying to yourself, Reverend Casey, wasn't this supposed to be a sermon about covenant and doing the right thing? And also, what does any of this have to do with rainbows? So the covenant that we read every week at the church where I serve as the minister reads, love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament. Service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve humanity in covenant, in fellowship, thus do we covenant. And as Unitarian Universalist congregations, our associational covenant includes the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning. The goal of world community, with peace, liberty, and justice for all. You could spend years just pulling apart some of those words. Love, truth, peace, knowledge, freedom, justice, compassion, community. But right now I'd like to go back to Baldwin. The work I quoted from earlier about stars aflame and an upheaval in the universe is, as much of Baldwin's work is, dedicated to working through the particularities of the Black experience of his time. Throughout this work, Baldwin is wrestling with anger, trauma, the failures of Christianity, and the bubbling up of history in the lives of people of all races. The disorientation he is actually speaking to in that moment is his understanding of what white folks experience when people of color who have long held the role of fixed star of designated inferior stop living in that role and, oh no, white people have to rearrange our whole concept of how the universe goes. The title of the work, The Fire Next Time, comes from a couplet in the spiritual Mary, Don't You Weep, which addresses the hopelessness experienced by enslaved peoples with biblical stories of God's acts of justice for the oppressed. Expressions of their hope of the fulfillment of God's covenants with those who follow them, or at least punishment for those who surely fail to. The couplet says, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, but fire next time. In the story of Noah from roughly Genesis 6:9 through 9:17, God is really angry at how violent humans are being towards one another and decides to flood the whole planet. Judging Noah to be righteous, God commands him to build an ark and, well, you probably know the rest. In the end, God puts a rainbow in the sky as a sign of his covenant with Noah, the promise that God would never flood the earth again. The fire doesn't come until 2 Peter 3:7, in which during a discussion of the flood, St. Peter states, by the same word, heaven and earth are now held in reserve for fire. Now, neither Baldwin nor I is much of a literalist. And in Baldwin's understanding, this promise plays out more as a prescient take on how humans, contemporary Americans in particular, but humans broadly, will succeed in destroying one another if we refuse to accept the press of time and deal finally with the history, construction, and perpetuation of race and racism. He writes, "Time catches up with kingdoms and crushes them. It gets its teeth into doctrines and rends them. Time reveals the foundations on which any kingdom rests and eats at those foundations. It destroys doctrines by proving them to be untrue. History is coming. All that is undealt with in our collective psyche, all the violence and pain that underwrites the vast arc of the United States and, in fact, global history, will eventually eat away at even the nicest myths and misremembering about those unified and apolitical moments before we had to think about any of this. It will do this until it becomes impossible to see anything but the decay that was always hidden beneath those eerily perfect veneers. History is coming. But we need not be plowed over by it as we continue to pretend it isn't still here." Baldwin writes, "In order to change a situation, one has to first see it for what it is. To accept one's past, one's history, is not the same thing as drowning in it. It is learning how to use it. An invented past can never be used. It cracks and crumbles under the pressures of life, like clay in a season of drought." One of the most common refrains of my ministry is that an accurate accounting of history is necessary in order to appropriately face and build the future. I tell my people all the time that in order to create or live any sort of meaningful covenant, you have to take time to pause and sort through the various and sometimes clashing narratives of your life to arrive at a sense of who you are and what you are called to do. If we wish, as a faith, to covenant together, to promise to one another that we wish to live together in our search for truth, knowledge, and freedom, if we're going to say that we are concerned with justice, community, peace, compassion, or love, we must inspect those places where we, too, are tempted to get lost in our memories or swept up in a neat story about a past that never was. In the end, our friend Harold from Cuisine de Memoir takes to heart his experience of being rebuked and chastened by both his friend and the waitstaff. He does some work on himself. He gives up his desire to fixate on his memory of love. He ceases to wish to hold his life in emotional stasis. He gives up his next reservation at the restaurant and calls his beloved ex-wife. Among the calls of our community, our existent promises to one another as I hear and have made them, is a call to help one another to work on ourselves, to encourage one another to be flexible, in motion, growing, and humble enough to handle being wrong. We are called as a community to take seriously the quieter histories, the stories we missed or were never told, to understand the truth more fully, to grieve the violence and complacency of our pasts, and work towards healing, which allows us to grow more loving more compassionate, and more free. We are called by our commitments to one another and by life itself to learn to be present, to rejoice or weep in the facts of life as they come, and further, to reduce those sources of unnecessary sorrow we impart on one another out of ignorance, callousness, or alienation from the workings of our society. We are called to engage fully in life, to, as Baldwin puts it, earn our deaths by confronting with passion the conundrum of life, in whatever fashion most suits us, realizing always that life is never made of only one of us. May we answer these calls to freedom bravely, facing the shifting terrain of our lives, not with platitudes and tidy, comfortable stories, but with the spirit of deep and true love which invites us to grow. May we engage with our pain in ways that are healing, which expand our capacity for compassion and care, while distancing us from narratives which allow us to use our experiences of wounding to perpetuate injury into the world. May we think about, examine, and take responsibility for our participation in governance at all levels of society, whether or not there's a horse in the hospital. May we be humble enough to resist our own pride in being right, knowing that we too fall short of our best selves. May we not cling to constants. May we grow comfortable with change. May we learn to be free together. Amen. Blessed be.